أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Sufi Reflections. On a regular, irregular basis, this podcast is intended, God willing, to introduce you to a wide variety of commentaries, ideas, stories, essays, discussions, interviews, and perspectives concerning not only the Sufi path or tasawwuf, but life in general as well. Through fact, fiction, possibilities, questions, and reflections, this podcast seeks to engage you on a journey of discovery in relation to issues and themes of relevance and significance to everyday life. I am not a sheikh, but I have, by the grace of Allah, been on the Sufi path for over 30 years, and I have benefited greatly by working closely with a Sufi saint of the 20th century for nearly two decades. This podcast is not about trying to guide people on the path, but rather to share some of what I and others have learned in conjunction with pursuing a Sufi way of life. My name is Bill Whitehouse, and God willing, I shall be your host for Sufi Reflection.
This week's edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life.
O ye who so long feeding on the husk forego the fruit, and doting on the dusk of the false dawn, are blinded to the true, that in the maiden of this world pursue, the golden ball which, driven to the goal, wins the world's game, but loses your own soul. Or like the children after baubles run, that still elude your fingers, or, if one, burst in derision at your touch, all thin glitter without, an empty wind within. So as a prosperous worldling on the bed of death, behold, I am as one, he said, who all my life long have been measuring wind, and dying, now leave even that behind. This world's a nest in which the cockatrice is warmed and hatched of vanity and vice, a false bazaar whose wares are all a lie, or never worth the price at which you buy. A many-headed monster that's supplied, the faster is unsatisfied. So as one, hearing a rich fool one day to God for yet one another blessing pray, bid him no longer bounteous heaven tire for life to feed, but death to quench the fire. And what are all the vanities and wiles in which the false world decks herself and smiles, to draw men down into her harlot lap, lust of the flesh that soul and body sap, and melting soul down into carnal lust, even that for which 'tis sacrificed disgust, or lust of worldly glory, hollow more than the drum beaten at the sultan's door, and fluctuating with the breath of man, as the vain banner flapping in the van. And lust of gold, perhaps of lust the worst, the miscreated idol most accursed, that between man and him who made him stands, the felon that with suicidal hands he sweats to dig and rescue from his grave, and sets at large to make himself its slave. For lo, to what worse than oblivion gone, are some the cozening world most doted on. Pharaoh tried glory, and his chariots drowned. Karun with all his gold went underground. Down toppled Nembroth with his airy stare. Shaddad among his roses lived, but where? And as the world upon her victims feeds, so she herself goes down the way she leads. For all her false allurements are the threads the spider from her entrail spins and spreads, for home and hunting ground, and by darts at due signal on the tangled fly, seizes, diswings, and drains the life and leaves the swinging carcass and forthwith reweaves her web, each victim adding to the store of poison entrail to entangle more. And so she bloats in glory, till one day the master of the house, passing that way, perceives, and with one flourish of his broom, of web and fly and spider, clears the room. This is from the poetry and writings of Fariduddin Attar. May Allah be pleased with him. One of the features that, God willing, will run fairly regularly on this podcast is a segment entitled Sufi Essays. As the title suggests, these pieces will be commentaries, sometimes brief and sometimes longer, about a variety of topics which, hopefully, may provide you with some thoughts on which to reflect. Today's essay is entitled Guidance. Many of us want to blaze our own path in life. We are inclined to explore where, when, and what we wish. We believe we should think for ourselves. We assume responsibility for analyzing events according to our methodology and interests. We feel a need to draw our own independent conclusions. Many of us are predisposed to suppose that purpose, meaning, value, and significance should all be discovered or invented or created by us. This is our way of marking territory, clearing paths, and fashioning a philosophical homestead in the wilderness of raw experience. This kind of rugged individualism is all right up to a point. However, it cannot take the place of spiritual guidance. The spiritual wheel has already been invented. There is not only no need to reinvent it, this wheel cannot be generated through human effort, irrespective of how intelligent or talented or resourceful we may be. There is a strong tendency among many people to act as if spirituality can be pieced together into its original wholeness by a perspicacious bit of consumerism. For example, we read books on mysticism and select that which seems to be most useful and important, as if we were going through a bargain bin and could distinguish value from trash. We go to talks on spirituality or watch television programs on the subject. Along the way, we take in a valued clue here and an interesting possibility there. As a result, we begin to paint a picture of the mystical path. We proceed like we were accomplished artists who know all about spiritual perspective, or how to make our own mystical pigments from scratch, or what colors were necessary to give balance and cohesion to the painting. We seem to believe composition and subject matter merely involve letting our imaginations speak their creative truths for all to admire. We become eclectic in our selections. We seem to believe if one mystical tradition is good, weaving together elements from 6 or 7 traditions has got to be even better. We are oblivious to the fact that different spiritual traditions are the way they are for a reason. They have a history. They have a context. They often have specific target audiences in mind. They emerge for a purpose, and they may have declined or disappeared for a purpose. Many of us seem to behave as if we were mystical cardiac specialists working in the emergency room of modernity. We encounter a spiritual tradition which is ancient and apparently barely alive, and we believe we have the capacity to resuscitate the nearly moribund patient through sheer skill and will on our part. As a result, we often make the patient suffer through our arrogance and pride. Some of us tend to be true progeny of our technological age. We have come to the conclusion spiritual traditions of the past need to be updated and proceed to do this according to fashion and fancy. We throw out parts which seem to have no relevance to modern sensitivities. We tack on features which appear to render the traditional consonant with modern knowledge and understanding. We believe we are pushing back the frontiers of spiritual wisdom. Little do we suspect how right we are. We have become the sorcerer's apprentice, wreaking havoc and destruction with each new incantation and wave of the wand. In the master's absence, we have got in over our head and have no idea how to stem the tide of rising, turbulent waters. The practitioners of the Sufi path stipulate very clearly that guidance can only come from God. Guidance is not within the purview of human beings. Prophets, saints, guides, as well as our own hearts and minds, are not the primary source of guidance. God is. The spiritual personalities who have a guiding function do so much in the way that water is released when sluice gates are raised. As such, the human role in guidance becomes a matter of the structural intricacies of the gating process through which water is channeled and regulated. The modality of release obviously has significance and importance, but the water for which the gate was constructed comes from God, as does the design for and operation of the gate. Sheikhs are the living exemplars who give expression to spiritual guidance which comes from God. In a sense, they are mediums of communication in which the noise-to-signal ratio has become vanishingly small. At the same time, the signal-to-noise ratio has become almost pure, if not pure, signal. Spiritual guides have different multi-channel capacities for handling various dimensions of the divine signal which come for the benefit of human beings. Nonetheless, whatever spiritual signals come through a particular spiritual capacity is undistorted, clear, and pure. Indeed, a very important part of the guidance which comes through spiritual teachers is to show us how to eliminate the number one source of noise interfering with one hearing divine communication, namely, the ego. Spiritual guides are valuable resources in this respect because they show that the potential of human beings is when the noise of the ego is removed and only the pure signal of divinity remains. From the perspective of Sufi masters, anyone who supposes he or she can storm the bastions of spirituality through her or his own cleverness and talent will be repulsed. Such forays are the work of the ego and are always doomed to failure. We cannot find truth or understand truth unless God wishes us to do so. We are powerless and defenseless without divine assistance and support. One of the essential forms of such assistance and support is spiritual guidance. There are many commodities in society which, because of their value and significance, become the focus of counterfeit operations. Currency, paintings, stamps, sculpture, historical artifacts, and jewels are just a few of the items which some people seek to imitate for their personal gain. Similarly, spiritual guidance is now and has been in the past subject to counterfeit attempts. This is as true for the Sufi mystical path as it has been for other mystical traditions. Due to the inestimable value and significance which authentic spiritual guidance has for human beings, there always have been those who were interested in exploiting the situation and trying to pass off the false for the real. The people who did this stood to gain money, fame, influence, power, and status. The existence of counterfeit spirituality poses a considerable problem for would-be seekers. To seek means one has not yet found what one is seeking. Moreover, the seeker after the mystical path may have only a vague idea of that for which one is looking. In a very real sense, one only will know precisely what one is looking for after one has arrived at one's spiritual destination. Since the seeker has not arrived, the seeker is not in any position to differentiate counterfeit spirituality from the genuine article. This places one at a distinct disadvantage if and when one encounters spiritual con artists. Caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, seems as good a maxim as any to keep in mind at this point. Although practitioners of the Sufi path have indicated no one can be his or her own mystical guide, nevertheless, this does not mean one has to become brain dead. God has given us reason, logic, judgment, common sense, and reflection as tools to use to help us sort through certain kinds of information and experience. God also has provided us with a heart with which to listen for and detect spiritual resonances. If we weigh matters carefully, if we are sincere in our intentions, if we try to listen to our innermost being, if we seek divine guidance on the matter, then God willing, will be far less likely to be fooled than if we merely rushed headlong into something in a rather naive, unreflective, imprudent manner. One's spiritual well-being, as well as one's emotional, mental, physical, and financial well-being, may be on the line. Therefore, one ought to have and give some care and consideration for that which potentially is being placed at risk. Unfortunately, on the human side of the equation, there are no guarantees for arriving at correct decisions. Only God can make guarantees stand up. Indeed, this is precisely why finding a legitimate way to place our affairs in the care of divine guidance becomes so crucial and vital. With your whole heart and soul, seek to regain reality. Nay, seek for reality within your own heart, for reality and truth is hidden within you. The heart is the dwelling place of that which is the essence of the universe. Within the heart and soul is the very essence of God. Like the saints, make a journey into yourself. Like the lovers of God, cast one glance within. As a lover now, in contemplation of the beloved, be unveiled within and behold the essence. Form is a veil to you, and your heart is a veil. When the veil vanishes, you will become all light. This is from Farid Uddin Attar. May Allah be pleased with him.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
وَالشَّمْسِ وَضُحَاهَا وَالْقَمَرِ إِذَا تَلَاهَا وَالنَّهَارِ إِذَا جَلَّاهَا والليل إذا يغشاها والسماء وما بناها والأرض وما طحاها ونفس وما سواها فألهمها فجورها وتقواها قد أفلح من زكاها وقد خاب من دساها.
By the sun and his brightness, and the moon when she followeth him, and the day when it revealeth him, and the night when it enshroudeth him, and the heaven and him who built it, and the earth and him who spread it, and a soul and him who perfected it, and inspired it with conscience of what is wrong for it and what is right for it. He is indeed successful who causeth it to grow, and he is indeed a failure who stunteth it.
كذبت ثمود بطغواها إذ انبعث أشقاها فقال لهم رسول الله ناقة الله وسقياها فكذبوه فعقروها فدمدم عليهم ربهم بذنبهم فسواها ولا يخاف عقباها.
The tribe of Thamud denied the truth in their rebellious pride when the basest of them broke forth. And the messenger of Allah said, "It is the she-camel of Allah, so let her drink." But they denied him, and they hamstrung her. So Allah doomed them for their sin and razed their dwellings. He dreadeth not the sequel of events.
From near the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy, you are listening to the Sufi Reflections podcast.
This story is called Etymology, and it comes from the collection of short stories entitled Mystical Horizons, Spiritual Stories for the Heart. A group of people had gathered at the home of their spiritual guide. Following prayers, songs, chanting, and a eulogy in remembrance of mystics of earlier days, the meeting was opened up for discussion. "So," the teacher inquired, "what would you like to reflect upon this evening? What food for thought can we offer you?" As various members of the group were wondering what issues or concerns should be put forward for consideration, one of the individuals present, a newcomer, said, "I've heard different descriptions concerning the essential nature of human beings, and sometimes I find myself confused because although there are similarities and commonalities among such descriptions, there also seem to be differences. Anything you have to say about this topic would be very helpful to me." The teacher raised his eyebrows in a display of interest. "This is a very, very good question." He lowered his head and was silent for a few seconds, and then he raised his head and said, "Why don't we see what people here have to say about your question?" Someone in the group quipped, "Isn't that like asking the blind to lead the blind?" The teacher and the rest of the group laughed. When the laughter had died down, the teacher replied, "Not necessarily. You know, according to some native spiritual traditions, when you sit in a circle as we are doing, then the spiritual and creative energy of the gathering often become focused at the center, and sometimes, as a result, a very elegant and educational process transpires. Therefore, as is the case with native spiritual traditions, why don't we allow ourselves to be open to some of the possibilities of the moment?" The teacher paused briefly and then asked of the group in general, "How would you describe the essential nature of a human being?" Silence descended upon the group as everyone became preoccupied with the questions which had been placed before them. After a minute had passed, the woman asked, "Is it all right to tell a joke that might be related to this issue?" "Why not?" the teacher said rhetorically and encouraged the woman to go ahead. "Maybe you've heard this before, or maybe in a different version, but anyway, there was this mystic who used to travel about the town proclaiming, 'I am greater than God, I am greater than God.'
Naturally, the mystic's words were very, very upsetting to the religious orthodoxy. And they decided to drag the offending wretch before a tribunal and demand that the miscreant recant. When the mystic stood before the stern-looking judges, one of the jurors thundered down at the poor fool before them, "Yes or no? Have you been going all about town claiming you are greater than God?" "Yes," the man said in a manner which suggested the judge was belaboring the obvious. "This is blasphemous," all three judges said in unison. "Not really," the man retorted. "Young man," one of the judges said, "are you so hopeless that you fail to understand nothing is greater than God?" "You've got it, your worship," replied the man. A quizzical look appeared on the judge's face, and then he gave the smile of a debater who believes he is about to score points. "What? That you are hopeless? Or that you fail to understand that nothing is greater than God, or both?" The judge said triumphantly as he leaned back against his plush chair with the high backrest, looking left and right at his colleagues. "Actually, none of those," the man replied. "I was mistaken. I thought you understood what I was getting at when you asked your question. Indeed, nothing is greater than God, and no one knows better than me that I am nothing. So therefore, I must be greater than God." The man thought a bit more and added, "This really is just classical logic, gentlemen. Quite elementary, really, although some people may wish to quibble with the idea of nothing has undergone a change of reference as one goes from premise to premise and then to the conclusion. However, as we mystics often like to say, well, me anyway, it's all a matter of perspective." Everybody, including the teacher, enjoyed the story. The teacher commented with, "There is a great deal of truth in that story. Thank you for sharing it with us." And then he looked around and said, "Who's next?" A man sitting next to the woman who had told the joke spoke up next. "Your earlier reference to food for thought in the story we just heard reminded me of a description that I once heard concerning the essential nature of human beings. Namely, we are like onions." In other words, when we begin to take a look at our nature and what, if anything, actually belongs to us, the reality of the human condition is that after we get done peeling away the physical body, the mind, our talents, abilities, and social relationships, and come to realize these all are made possible by and through God, then really, when we get to the heart of the matter, like an onion, there is nothing left to us. The teacher gave a warm smile to the answer. "Yes, yes, this is true in so many ways." At this point, a younger man said, "I actually read something once which, to me at least, sounds very different than the onion analogy. But to keep the theme of food going, the object which was used to give expression to human nature was a peach. This approach emphasized that a peach has two aspects, an outer fruit that is manifest, and an inner core around which the fruit grows, and from which the outer portion receives certain benefits and protections. Moreover, the peach pit is what makes a peach rather than something else. The core represents the capacity of the peach, its potential. If one accepts this peach analogy, then the essence doesn't really seem like it is nothing. After all, seemingly, different people exhibit different spiritual capacities, just like they exhibit an array of physical characteristics, intellectual abilities, artistic talents, and so on. Unless one wants to say that we are identical to God, which to my understanding no real mystic says, then presumably there is something more than nothingness at the heart of human nature. Well, this is what I read anyway, he concluded with a sudden bout of self-awareness, when he realized that the teacher had been listening attentively to what he was saying. The teacher shook his head in admiration. "Wherever you read this, son, the author is on the right track. This is very true. Very true." The newcomer, who had first raised the question about human nature, said, "I've liked everything that has been said so far, but would you say something on this topic?" The teacher tilted his head at a slight angle and raised his hand, pointing in the direction, first, of the woman who told the joke, and then towards the onion man next to her, and then to the peach of a young man. "These three people have spoken very elegantly. I don't know what I could add." The newcomer implored the teacher, "Please." The teacher thought for a moment and finally said, "There is one thing which does come to mind on this matter. There was this fellow in Mexico who was a gardener, and he had spent his whole life experimenting with various grafting techniques, and I seem to recall he made a big splash down there when he was able to successfully cross a peach with an onion. And they referred to him as the peon man. This is where the origin of the word peon comes from, and you people here may or may not know that peon is Spanish for servant." As people were mulling over the teacher's comments, one of the people in the group, who was a linguist and a history buff, said, "Sir, I don't mean to contradict what you are saying, but really, that is not the correct etymology of the term peon, and unfortunately, I think your history is, shall we say, a little shaky too?" The teacher laughed and had a twinkle in his eyes when he said, "Etymologically and historically, you may be correct. But what I have just said is nonetheless spiritually true. Human essence is really a something which is nothing, or a nothing which is something, depending on your point of view. And in either case, human essence exists to serve divinity."
The following is an unpaid advertisement by the sponsors of this podcast. It concerns the newly released book, The Chaco Canyon Tapes.
The Chaco Canyon Tapes by Dr. Bill Whitehouse is a book which is difficult to categorize. While it has the appearance of a novel, the work is really a series of essays focusing on an array of contemporary issues. In fact, the novel aspect itself constitutes a distributed essay which weaves its way through the different dimensions of the book. Simultaneously, the storyline provides an emotional, creative center of gravity which is intended to help stabilize as well as lend both a source of coherency and accessibility to the various topics developed throughout the Chaco Canyon Tapes. In its capacity as a novel, the book traces the journey of a psychology professor, David Phelps, who traverses a path from an initial agnosticism at the story's inception to a budding acceptance of spiritual possibilities at the story's conclusion. In its capacity as a series of essays, the chapters constitute the experientially based contemplative exercises that are shaping and coloring the central figure's spiritual transformation. The story ranges across an assortment of kidnappings, murders, mysteries, intrigues, rescues, and relationships. The plot development, characterization, dialogue, as well as the dramatic tension and resolution of this story are employed to induce readers to undertake a quest somewhat similar to that of the main character. However, The reader's journey need not be so much a matter of following the travels of David Phelps, which extend from agnosticism to belief, as much as it is a journey of opportunity to engage from a spiritual perspective a set of important interrelated issues of our times. This is not a book of metaphysics, theology, or religious polemic. Rather, it is an invitation to experience, within determinate limits, a certain kind of spiritual orientation and ambiance while pushing against problems which frame human existence. Purpose, identity, meaning, valuation, understanding, justice, freedom, responsibility, potential, commitment, and choice are very much at the heart of Chaco Canyon. This story of spiritual awakening, together with its concomitant thematic explorations, provide a context for reflecting on matters of fundamental concern to all of us.
To order a copy, just go to http://spiritual-health.org/Chaco Canyon, that's capital C, H-A-C-O, capital C-A-N-Y-O-N, all one word, .htm. Order your copy today without delay. Without further ado, we will return you to the regularly scheduled portions of the Sufi Reflections podcast. The title of this poem is called Life, a Work in Progress. Echoes of death lap the shores of my being, harbingers of a tide that is yet to come, when negation rolls in and life ebbs away. Time stalks me, haunts me, taunts briefly, then is gone, an undertow which lures and sweeps me along, according to a purpose that's yet unknown. Transformations mark stages of becoming, along chaotic paths that disappear in mists of incompleteness, leaving no trace to find. Deep within, a mystery I am feeling, not clearly, but in colored shadows which move like an owl in the night, asking, who are you? My spirit yearns to see what is calling to me from behind the veil of life's mystery, to know why I am rather than not at all. Caught between forces of give in and go on, while waiting for the first light of dawn, my heart fights back tears laced with the salt of earthly fears. Beauty weaves a melody which mingles with my soul, harmony flowing from God's grace against counterpoints of discord from me. Alien places, inviting and vaguely familiar, reach out through framed symbols of estrangement, trapped beneath life's surface hues. Winds of loneliness swirl about me nightly, bringing the chill of freedom to mortal bones. Around me, I wrap my cloak of friendship tightly. Doubt kindles a smoldering uncertainty, questions boil in a cauldron of possibility. Answers whisper their secrets with subtlety. On the edge of a truth, much is left to see.
You are listening to the Sufi Reflections Podcast, a source for essays, stories, interviews, commentaries, music, poetry, and more concerning the Sufi path.
The Sufi path is not just about aspiring to spiritual understanding concerning the potential of one's inherent God-given capacity, but as well, tasawwuf should entail an application of spiritual principles to the problems and events of everyday life. Consequently, from time to time, this podcast will offer reflections on different facets of various social, political, economic, and ecological issues of the day. The purpose of these commentaries is not to induce people to pursue this or that action or policy. Rather, the intention of such commentaries is to provide food for thought, which, God willing, may serve to support responsible, moral, considered action according to one's circumstances and best understanding. For want of a better name, I refer to these occasional commentaries as White House Briefs. Although given my nature, some of the commentaries are not always so brief. The title of today's White House Briefs is Fatwa. A fatwa is a legal opinion concerning some dimension of Sharia, and is given by people who supposedly are competent to give such opinions. However, there is nothing binding upon Muslims with respect to the issuing of such an edict. A fatwa is a legal brief. If one is persuaded by the structure of the argument and logic contained in this sort of document, then one may use such a presentation to shape one's intentions in conjunction with some spiritual problem or other with which one is attempting to struggle. If, alternatively, one is not persuaded by the arguments contained in such a brief, then really, one can dismiss the document without prejudice. In a book entitled What is Right with Islam by Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, there is a fatwa which appears in an appendix in that book. The heading for the fatwa is, quote, Fatwa permitting U.S. Muslim military personnel to participate in Afghanistan war effort, end of quote. This fatwa was not written by the author of the above-mentioned book. Rather, it is the collective effort of five individuals who hail from Qatar, Egypt, and Syria. Notwithstanding the foregoing issue of authorship of the fatwa, the author of What is Right with Islam does mention in the main text of the book how he had recommended to the New York Times that they publish the fatwa. Furthermore, by not commenting on the fatwa and permitting the fatwa to stand as it is without critical or evaluative remarks, he has given his tacit endorsement to what is being said by the five framers of the aforementioned fatwa. Ostensibly, the fatwa was generated in response to some inquiries by the, quote, most senior chaplain of the American Armed Forces, end of quote. Nothing was said about the circumstances under which the five authors of the fatwa were approached by the chaplain, or why these people in particular were consulted, or whether efforts had been made to obtain any other determination, dissenting or otherwise, in conjunction with the presenting problem. A critical analysis of the fatwa in question will be given in the following commentary. This commentary is not a counter-fatwa, but it does serve as a dissenting voice, and it encompasses a perspective which people might wish to consider when reflecting not only on the issue of whether Muslim armed services personnel should participate in wars against other Muslims, but as well the whole issue of what constitutes justifiable homicide in relation to people in general. Early in the fatwa, one finds the following, quote, All Muslims ought to be united against all those who terrorize the innocents and those who permit killing of non-combatants without a justifiable reason, end of quote. The authors of the fatwa do not say what they mean by being quote-unquote united, but one might offer the possibility that certain factions within the U.S. government, both present and past, certainly qualify as being among those who any person of decency would be opposed to, if in no other way than speaking out the truth in the face of tyranny. Very serious and fundamental questions, for example, concerning legitimacy, justice, morality, and fairness, could be raised about U.S. involvement in, to but name but a few, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Indonesia, the Philippines, Iran, Iraq, Africa, Palestine, and most of Latin America. If terrorizing of innocents and the killing of non-combatants without justifiable reason is the issue, then one may want to expand one's frame of reference and think about state-sponsored terrorism in conjunction with more than just Afghanistan. However, irrespective of whom is terrorizing whom, none of this justifies killing and terrorizing innocent people during the process of tracking down criminals and apprehending them. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of innocents have been killed in collectively Afghanistan, Iraq, the Balkans, and the Sudan by a self-serving, reprehensible U.S. government policy. And one might note that with respect to the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, which was mistakenly bombed by order of William Jefferson Clinton as a suspected plant for producing weapons of mass destruction, which it was proven not to be, this was the one source of pharmaceuticals for Sudan that was lost, and as a result, tens of thousands of innocent people died from diseases and infections for which no pharmaceuticals were available to use in treatment. In any case, whether one is talking about people in Afghanistan, Iraq, the Balkans, Sudan, or elsewhere, there was no due process to establish that such people were aiding, abetting, providing safety and comfort for, or helping to finance the perpetrators of any crimes. Property was destroyed in all of the foregoing countries. People have been terrorized, innocents have been slain, international conventions have been broken, war crimes have been committed, a rogue government has run amok in the world, but since this is all done behind a facade of words such as freedom, humanitarian, liberation, justice, democracy, and rule of law, then everyone should understand that the unfortunates who have had to die, starve, become ill, for instance through depleted uranium munitions, as well as the diseases which have been sprung loose through the systematic destruction of infrastructure, that people who are uprooted into refugee status and suffer, well, all of this is for a good and noble cause. U.S. hegemony, that is the control of one country over another, in which, like ancient Greece, only the real citizens, i.e. the perpetrators of crimes, get the consent to how they are to be governed. Everyone else is mere chattel or fodder or deserving of exploitation and manipulation. The fatwa continues with, quote, "We find it necessary to apprehend the true perpetrators of these crimes as well as those who aid and abet them through incitement, financing, or other support. They must be brought to justice in an impartial court of law." End of quote. Of course, the U.S. government does not consider the World Court to be an impartial venue of law because the World Court had the audacity to find the U.S. government guilty of violating Nicaraguan sovereignty, as well as conducting illegal blockades and systematically destroying the economy and people of Nicaragua. Nor does the U.S. government consider the United Nations an impartial court of law, because the United Nations has had the temerity to seek to place constraints on how or when or if the U.S. wields its considerable military might, not to mention that the U.S. government objects to being reminded that for almost 40 years it has been stonewalling Resolution 242, which indicates, among other things, that no country, for instance Israel, has the right to hold on to territory gained through hostilities, or the U.S. government wishes to ignore Resolution 687, which says, among other things, that once the matter in Iraq is settled to the satisfaction of the United Nations Security Council, something which is unlikely to happen because the U.S. will veto anything that it is not in accordance with its plans for hegemony, then all weapons of mass destruction, including the nuclear weapons possessed by Israel, must be eliminated from the Middle East. The U.S. government finds such matters of international agreement inconvenient for its purposes of realpolitik, and therefore blames the failure of the UN on everyone but the real source of difficulty, which is undermining UN effectiveness, namely the United States government. No, the only impartial court of law is the vigilante system of the armed forces and the kangaroo courts known as military tribunals. Apparently, the only people who can be trusted are those who are infected with the same mental and spiritual disease, even though many truly independent people might see this as a conflict of interest with respect to basic issues of justice, fairness, and objectivity. Really, what is the difference between what Osama and company have done and are doing, or what the U.S. government has done and is doing? Neither of these parties have bothered much with determining who the true perpetrators are. Neither of these parties have concerned themselves much with due process. Neither of these parties have given any evidence that they are concerned about whether or not the people who die or those who are terrorized or the property which is destroyed or the individuals who suffer are in fact guilty of anything except being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Osama claims that the people who died in the Twin Towers were guilty because they paid taxes and therefore aided and abetted the actions of the U.S. government. Oddly enough, and quite ironically, Osama seems not to have realized that there are many individuals, both homeless and corporate, who do not pay any tax, and yet such people die through the implementation of his plan, or they will die through succumbing to the respiratory diseases and other toxic particulates that are being breathed by people in New York City as a result of the destruction of the World Trade Center, in which, according to different news accounts, are already showing up with rising demographics of disease, disability, and death. One might also ask Osama if he or any of his fellow architects of destruction bothered to check to see whether, among the people who would be in the Twin Towers on that tragic day, there were individuals present who were not U.S. taxpayers, but may have been tourists from overseas, or who were there as individuals conducting business on behalf of a company located in a foreign country. Or maybe there were government officials visiting the Twin Towers who were from other countries. It makes no difference whether or not such people were in the Twin Towers. The fact of the matter is this: these kind of people could have been in the towers in 9/11, and therefore the intention to destroy lives was done in a state of knowing ignorance. More specifically, Osama bin Laden and the other perpetrators of the tragedy knew they didn't know whether or not there were any innocents in those towers, and as a result, his entire post facto justification for his feeling okay about killing people who might have been innocent because everyone pays taxes and therefore there were no innocents is entirely specious. For as the book which Osama claims to live by, namely the Quran, indicates, if even one innocent person is killed, it is as if the whole of humanity were killed. Osama stands condemned by his own logic and values. However, whether the people who died in the Twin Towers were or were not taxpayers, they were innocents. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, indicated that one may not wage war on the elderly, women, children, non-combatants, and one may not seek to destroy the means of livelihood of a people. Osama bin Laden and his cohorts broke each facet of the foregoing prohibitions. They decided they knew better than the Prophet, and they also were of the opinion that they knew better than the Quran, and the only thing which mattered to them was their self-serving interpretation of the situation, unconstrained by such meddlesome, tedious irrelevancies as facts, evidence, proof, due process, objectivity, integrity, fairness, and justice. Returning to the text of the fatwa, the brief seeks to address the whole problem of an individual having to differentiate the innocent from, quote, the true perpetrators, end of quote. Therefore, at a certain point, the fatwa offers a hadith of the Prophet which says, quote, when two Muslims face each other in fighting, and one kills the other, then both the killer and the killed are in the hellfire. Someone said, We understand that the killer is in hell. Why then the one who's been killed? The prophet said, because he wanted to kill the other person. End of quote. The fatwa continues on with, quote, the noble hadith mentioned above only refers to the situation where the Muslim is in charge of his affairs. He is capable of fighting or not fighting. The situation does not address the situation where a Muslim is a citizen of a state and a member of a regular army. In this case, he has no choice but to follow orders. End of quote. I love the way people make things up on the fly. Unless a human being is mentally incompetent, one always is in charge of his or her affairs, at least with respect to the choices one makes. One choice a person has is not to join the military in the first place. One's country can be served in many ways, and being a patriot does not necessarily entail that one must kill others or destroy their property and infrastructure in order to have sincerity of commitment to the core values of the United States. Another choice one has is to choose a court-martial over killing innocent people. Alternatively, one might seek to become a conscientious objector. In other words, if, before the fact of enlistment, one were not aware of the extent to which innocent lives are terrorized and brutalized by modern warfare, then surely when one becomes aware of this, one has a strong argument for disengaging from such activities, an argument which is rooted in moral principle and is not sullied by either cowardice nor lack of love for and patriotism towards one's country. Why the military would want to hang on to people to kill others when the hearts and souls of such people are morally and spiritually not in sync with such actions is a puzzle. Surely the military must recognize that it takes courage to say no to the killing of innocents, especially when the military is likely to take harsh action simply because in this land of democratic freedoms, the military leadership, bold warriors that they are, feel threatened by an act of moral conscience. On the other hand, if everyone were to act in accordance with his or her moral conscience rather than submit to orders, perhaps the military might not have enough bodies to carry out the wishes of its masters in the government, and this just won't do. Being in charge of one's affairs does not mean one has control over the ramifications of one's choices, nor does it mean one will enjoy the consequences of one's choices. However, one always is in charge of how one exercises one's God-given capacity to choose. This is both the strength and vulnerability of being human, and it is shallow of these authors of the fatwa to suppose otherwise. I also would be curious as to what the reasoning is behind saying that the previous hadith does not address the situation in which a Muslim is, quote, a citizen of a state and a member of a regular army, end of quote. Did the Prophet inform the authors of the fatwa that this was the case? How does one know what the scope of the Prophet's words and intentions are in the case of the cited hadith? The fact of the matter is, we don't know. And so jurists create legal fictions in order to bridge the chasms into the unknown. In ecology, there is something called the precautionary principle. This precept indicates that when one is faced with a situation in which the consequences of one's actions may lead either to foreseeable problems or entail potential problems, which our limited state of understanding is not capable of foreseeing but is capable of contemplating, then it is better to err on the side of caution and wait until our ignorance becomes less, and as a result, we are better able to understand what is going on and what the consequences of our action will be. Thus, with respect to the aforementioned hadith, perhaps it is better to err on the side of caution and entertain the possibility that the scope of the Prophet's words may actually have encompassed what the authors of the fatwa say it does not, than to simply proceed without any justification and claim, as the authors of the fatwa do, that the hadith does not apply to Muslims who are citizens of a state and members of an army. The unsupported claim of a jurist, or even a number of them, does not take precedence over the guidance of the Prophet, peace be upon him. According to the authors of the fatwa, a Muslim who lives in a state where he or she is a member of a regular army, quote, has no choice but to follow orders. Otherwise, his allegiance and his loyalty to his country could be in doubt. This would subject him to much harm, since he would not enjoy the privileges of citizenship without performing its obligations. End of quote. Aside from the fact that it is better to lose the world and all its attendant privileges and allurements than it is to lose one's soul, and aside from the fact that it is better to, possibly, spend a few years in prison than to live an eternity in hell, it is unfortunate that the ideas of loyalty, allegiance, and obligations should be limited, as the authors of the fatwa urge, to doing what the purveyors of hegemony demand, rather than to serving the principles and purposes for which the United States came into existence, which certainly was not to embrace tyranny, injustice, immorality, and the destruction and terrorizing of innocent human beings. We all have an absolute obligation to truth and justice. If anything, our loyalty and allegiance as citizens of the United States are to the principles for which the United States was conceived, and not to the grotesque, sordid, soiled version to which the architects of hegemony wish to call citizens. There is no virtue in enjoying the privileges of citizenship that are predicated on the death, destruction, and oppression of others who are innocent. The harm to which one is exposed through blind taqlid, unquestioning adherence to immoral, unjust, and ill-conceived orders, is not loss of the enjoyment of the privileges of citizenship. It is the loss of one's way of life. At one point in the play A Man for All Seasons, Thomas More is cross-examining one of the people who have perpetrated false witness against him. And Thomas More asks the man what the medallion is which the individual wears around his neck. The man explains that it is emblematic of being the Chancellor of Wales, to which Thomas More responds with, quote, "Whereas Holy Scripture tells us that it would not profit a man if he were to gain the whole world, yet were to lose his soul. But for Wales, Richard?" End of quote. Should we really encourage people to exchange the integrity and spiritual well-being of the soul for this or that worldly trinket, no matter what the hype or glitter surrounding that trinket may be? According to the authors of the fatwa, quote, "The Muslim soldier must perform his duty in this fight despite the feeling of uneasiness of fighting without discriminating. His intention, niyyah, must be to fight for enjoining of the truth and defeating falsehood. It's to prevent aggression on the innocents or to apprehend the perpetrators and bring them to justice. It's not his concern what other consequences of the fighting that might result in his personal discomfort, since he alone can neither control nor prevent it. Furthermore, all deeds are counted by God according to the intentions." End of quote. This notion that, quote, "it's not his, the soldier's, concern what other consequences of the fighting that might result in his personal discomfort," end of quote, resonates all too closely with a constant refrain of the people being prosecuted at the Nuremberg trials. Quote, "I was only following orders," end of quote. One of the principles arising out of those trials and which became a precedent of modern international law is this: one cannot use the excuse of following orders to justify participating in crimes against humanity. Furthermore, one should take issue with the contention of the authors of the fatwa that one person, quote, "alone can neither control nor prevent," end of quote, such events. Each person can control and prevent his or her own participation in whatever acts are repugnant to one's moral and spiritual commitments, and as well are in contravention of international law. Unfortunately, the authors of the fatwa seem to be intent on instilling a sense of learned helplessness in people. They are saying that if one individual cannot prevent such things from happening, then one should just permit oneself to be carried along by the flow of forces and not concern oneself about such matters, as if such matters were not encompassed by one's spiritual and moral responsibility as a human being to seek the good and avoid the evil. Furthermore, if I am a soldier, and therefore I know how war works, in theory, if not in practice, then I know that the way modern warfare is conducted will almost certainly lead to the killing of innocents, the destruction of the property of innocent people, and the terrorizing of innocent people. Given this knowledge, how does one form the intention that one will be fighting for truth and the defeating of falsehood, when the very first casualty of war is often truth itself? The plans for the invasion of Afghanistan had already been drawn up prior to 9/11, and 9/11 became a convenient justification or pretext for carrying out a plan which was in the works independently of 9/11. Afghanistan is today, as it has been for hundreds of years, a critical piece of the puzzle in the game of geopolitics. For instance, because Iran cannot be trusted by the U.S. government to do the right thing for the hegemony of the latter, the best, although not the shortest, route for the oil pipeline, gas pipelines, which has been on the drawing boards for quite some time, is through Afghanistan and over to Pakistan. The object all along has been to gain control of the oil and gas discoveries in the Caspian Sea region. The permanent military bases that are being built by the U.S. are all along the route of the proposed pipeline. In addition, such bases give the U.S. a ready set of staging areas to launch attacks on many places in that part of the world, which is also why the U.S. forces are being set up in, among other places, Uzbekistan. The quid pro quo of these arrangements is that Russia is given a free hand to do what it will with Chechnya and its resources, where oppression, wholesale slaughter, and the violation of basic rights are permitted as long as they do not impact on the agenda of certain dimensions of U.S. government, economic, and foreign policy. A policy that is steeped in the selfish, imperialistic, exploitive oils of hegemony with respect to the rest of the world. How is one fighting for truth and the elimination of falsehood when one seeks to stop the Taliban but does nothing to stop the opium trade going on in Afghanistan that supplies 90% of the raw resources for the heroin, which ends up on the streets of, among other places, the United States? How is one fighting for truth and the elimination of falsehood when the vast majority of innocents outside of Kabul still live in terror and uncertainty, both because of, as well as, in spite of a U.S. military presence? How is one fighting for truth and the elimination of falsehood when the policy of the U.S. government is to protect its interests rather than the interests of the average citizen of Afghanistan, or to suppose that its interests and needs are one and the same with the needs and interests of most of the inhabitants of that country? If God judges us according to our intentions, then how does one expect to fare when one knows that, propaganda aside, one is in many respects not fighting for truth and the elimination of falsehood, but rather one is fighting for the industrial military complex's desire to control the world and its resources? Does one not have an obligation to seek for the truth with respect to what one is being told? Are there not numerous sources via the internet, DVDs, books, magazines, and people like Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Edward Herman, Robert McChesney, Nafees Ahmed, Ralph Nader, Peter Montague, and others through whom to discover the evidence which discloses what is going on around the world as well as within the United States? Can we bury our minds and hearts in the toxic soil that is euphemistically called education in the United States and say, my intentions are pure and clear? Does God not see every little fleeting bit of evidence that we allow to slip through our consciousness unchallenged, which suggests that the truth is something other than what we are being asked to digest as the quote-unquote official line on things? Niyat is not something that forms in a vacuum. It is rooted in experience, and when the heart plays fast and loose with the truth of experience, then no matter what the superficial form of the intention may be, there is a subtext which flows in our heart of hearts and something of the truth registers within us. And it is this which is our true intention, not that which is given for public consumption, and it is this for which we will be held accountable. The authors of the fatwa in question maintain, quote, Muslim jurists have ruled that what a Muslim cannot control, he cannot be held accountable for. As God, the Most High, says, quote, and keep your duty to God as much as you can, end of quote. And this is from the Quran 64:16. The Prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, quote, when I ask of you to do something, do it as much as you can, end of quote. One's duty to God does not consist in enabling the military-industrial complex to acquire hegemony over the world. One's duty to God does not consist in killing innocent people, destroying their property, or terrorizing non-combatants. In addition, the Prophet hasn't asked one to do any of these things either. So contrary to what the authors of the fatwa are suggesting, we are not obligated to do as much of these things as we can. Moreover, one might ask the question, what does doing as much as one can entail? Isn't it ironic that in a country which claims it is democratic and based upon principles of justice, fairness, truth, and liberty, one is not free to exercise one's conscience without running the risk of suffering considerable punitive damages? Yet irrespective of whatever these damages may be, just as one is prepared to risk hardship in battle, one should be prepared to risk hardship in the cause of truth and justice. This is what we can do. This is an essential part of what it means to be a human being. The aforementioned fatwa says, quote, even if fighting causes him discomfort spiritually or psychologically, this personal hardship must be endured for the greater public good, as the jurisprudence or fiqh rule states. End of quote. And how does one calculate the greater public good? What values does one use? What methods does one apply? What criteria are to be consulted? According to the fatwa, the Muslim here, that is, the one who is a soldier, quote, is part of a whole. If he absconds, his departure will result in great harm, not only for him, but for the Muslim community in his country. And here, there are many millions of them, end of quote. What is this, quote, unquote, great harm which will accrue to the soldier of conscience and his community? Very little is said in this regard, but mention is made that if a person does not sell his or her soul to the military-industrial complex, then it could be that the allegiance and loyalty of Muslims will come into doubt. Allegiance and loyalty to what? To someone's warped way of dealing with the world? To someone's burning greed? To someone's indifference to the suffering of innocent people who are in the way of some geopolitical objective? To someone's desire to proceed through life in an immoral, illegal way that violates the norms of decency that have been established by many countries and many billions of people? Are the authors of the fatwa suggesting that in order not to have to deal with the unpleasantness of someone having doubts about where one's loyalties and allegiance lie, that one should betray the ideals of the Declaration of the Independence and the Constitution, not to mention one's relationship with God and the truth? Is it really okay to destroy innocent people by the thousands, to destroy their property, to destroy their means of livelihood, so that Muslims in America won't have to deal with someone questioning their loyalty and allegiance? Is this the greater good? The authors of the fatwa go on to say, quote, the questioner, a Muslim military chaplain, inquires about the possibility of the Muslim military personnel in the American armed forces to serve in the back lines, such as in the relief services sector and similar works. If such requests are granted by the authorities without reservation or harm to the soldiers or to other American Muslim citizens, then they should request that. Otherwise, if such a request raises doubts about their allegiance or loyalty, casts suspicions, presents them with false accusations, harm their future careers, shed misgivings on their patriotism or similar sentiments, then it is not permissible to ask for that. End of quote. Who and what is necessitating that it is not permissible to do this? Is it God? Is it the prophet? Well, actually, it isn't. It is a group of five jurists who are saying this is impermissible. Moreover, they are saying it is impermissible on the basis of dubious interpretations of what the Quran and Hadith have said. And why are they saying it is impermissible? Well, as everyone knows, the threat of harsh words, suspicions, doubts, false accusations, future careers, and the like are far more important than a few thousand lives over in Afghanistan or Iraq or elsewhere. This is the calculus of their jurisprudence. Whether the lives of the innocent people in Afghanistan, whose lives will be destroyed by a U.S. invasion, are Muslim or not Muslim, is immaterial. The Quran does not say, quote, if anyone killed a Muslim human being, unless it be in punishment for murder or for spreading mischief on earth, it would be as though he killed all of humanity, end of quote. And this is from Surah 5, verse 32. The Quran states the prohibition against killing without qualification as far as the identity, race, ethnicity, gender, religion, or beliefs of the individual being killed are concerned. The fatwa being examined here ends with, quote, this is in accordance with the Islamic jurisprudence rules, which state that necessities dictate exceptions, as well as a rule which says that one may endure a small harm to avoid a much greater harm, end of quote. The authors have stated things incorrectly by claiming that the principles of jurisprudence which they consider to be applicable actually demand what they are claiming. First, the much greater harm in the issue before the authors of the fatwa is the killing of innocent people rather than not having to endure the suspicions, doubts, and false accusations of others concerning one's loyalty, allegiance, duty, and patriotism, which they have identified as the greater harm. In addition, the greater harm is in enabling Muslims to kill others, whether these other human beings are Muslim or non-Muslim, without just cause and due process, and just because someone who has a hidden agenda says they should. Secondly, the principle that, quote, necessities dictate exceptions, end of quote, presupposes that it is necessary to kill innocent human beings, and the authors of the fatwa have not established this, nor will they ever be able to establish this. The killing of innocent human beings is never necessary, except in the schemes and machinations of those who lust after what does not belong to them and who have a pathological need to control the rest of the world. Well, that's all for this edition of the Sufi Reflections Podcast. I hope you have enjoyed the program and found the various segments thought-provoking and interesting. As indicated in the introduction to this podcast, programs will be produced on a regularly irregular basis. Essentially, this means that the next edition may appear next week, or then again, there may not be another podcast for several weeks. Sufi Reflections gets done, God willing, as time permits. And unfortunately, time doesn't always permit me the degrees of freedom necessary to put programs together, which is a lot more time-consuming than the running length of any given podcast. Nonetheless, I will strive mightily to provide a new program for your listening enjoyment in the near future. Until then, Assalamu alaikum.